On this episode of Still Loading, a guide to movie-based games. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Koval, and today on the show, I am interviewing another author. This has been a theme this year. I've been having a bunch of more authors on the show, and it's been wonderful getting to like experience all these different books. Once again, I will always like to be open and honest. I did receive a review copy of this book from the publisher, but with me today to discuss the book, A Guide to Movie-Based Video Games, is the author, Chris Carden. Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. Very excited.
Thank you for coming on the show. I've been looking forward to this chat because I like licensed games. I think it's always interesting seeing games from, you know, based off of movies and whatnot. The time of this recording, the panel has not happened. The time this episode releases, it will have already happened. But I'm doing a panel on James Bond in video games, and you have an entire chapter of this book devoted to James Bond in video games. So I actually read a little. I actually used part of your book as a little bit of preparation for this panel, which was very helpful.
Oh, that's fantastic! Thank you. I'm glad to see it's been getting some sort of use. James Bond is a big chunk of it. Yeah, it's great. It was fun to write.
I mean, there's lots of Bond games. There's a lot of what, and the crazy thing is like there's like I don't know, like there's so many out there. My first question, though, before we talk about the book, just so my listeners can get to know you a little bit better, let's talk about your history with gaming. Like, what are some of your earliest gaming memories? How did you get into video games and all that stuff? So, what's some of your earliest memories?
I was very fortunate to be born into a family as the youngest. So I have two older brothers, and my mother and my father and both of my brothers were always into gaming. So when I was born, we already had a Commodore 64 and an Amiga in our house, which was great. And I have two very distinct memories. The main memory I have is playing The Secret of Monkey Island, LucasArts point-and-click adventure on the Amiga, which came with about 60 floppy disks. And then there was a really strange platforming game I remember called CJ's Elephant Antics on the Commodore 64.
Okay.
That came on, you know, a little cassette. You had to like rewind, and so those two were my earliest memories. So I used to watch them playing them. My mom used to play Monkey Island a lot. My brothers would play, you know, various other games, Elevator Action, that kind of stuff. But my biggest memory is when we bought Sega Genesis. Would be to you, I suppose, and it was called
the
Mega
Drive. Yeah, you can call it the Mega Drive.
I call it the Mega Drive for purposes. So yeah, I remember, you know, buying that was just such a huge event because it was like the next level for us, and playing Sonic and all that kind of stuff. And since then, just been gaming my entire life, really.
I always find it amusing when people talk about like the Amiga and the Commodore 64 and everything, just because like we had the Commodore over here, but a lot of like those microcomputers that were really big over in the UK just did not hit the same over here in North America. So I'm always extra fascinated when people have memories of that, because it's like, you know, for me, I can at least, you know, if someone talks about an Atari, I can have a frame of reference for it, because I also, my uncle had an Atari, you know, like there's people within my vicinity that I could experience most of the eras of gaming history. But with microcomputers, and what was that elephant, CJ?
CJ's Elephant Antics.
CJ's Elephant Antics. Like, we would never have gotten stuff like that over here. If it did get released over here, I'm unaware of it. So yeah. I'm always fascinated by that. Also by the fact that this consistently blows my mind. There's video games on cassette tape. Like, I can't, like, that for some reason, that's just the strangest thing to me. Like, I've seen it. I've known about it for years, but it still is just the most foreign idea. Same thing with like games on VHS tapes, you know?
Yeah. And even looking back on it, like at the time, the cassette thing to us, it was just, that's what it comes on. That's the input. That's what you do. But looking back on it now, I'm like, how did that even work? I had to rewind the cassette and put it in, and the game would continue where it was. It was kind of bizarre. Really
that is so crazy.
Yeah.
So wait, when the cassette would run out, you would have to pause the game and rewind it?
Yeah, but it would somehow continue, you know, from where the game was. So I don't know how
that
it really works.
That is wild.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
And I only found out recently that like the NES and stuff like that was just not as big over here. Like people had it. I had cousins and stuff who had it, but it just wasn't the major thing. It was all these strange computers that kind of could crash at any moment.
Totally unreliable.
That's it, exactly. Yeah, and the, you know, there was Atari 2600 and stuff like that, and what was that one? BBC Micro, all these other kind of strange.
Yeah, that's one of the thing eras of gaming history I'm actually most fascinated about on a personal level, because it is so different from what I'm used to. And for better or worse, you kind of leave it up to the listener to decide. A lot of game history is very North American centric.
Yeah.
And so one of my favorite elements is like, I'm not the only one doing this by any stretch, but I always like asking people outside of North America about their game history, about their gaming memories, because it's vastly different from, because almost everyone talks about, you know, the NES and the Super Nintendo and, you know, Atari and all that other stuff here in North America. But, you know, like you said, the NES wasn't big for you guys over there.
Yeah.
Nintendo barely promoted it at all.
Yeah, they didn't really. Yeah.
It's wild. So, all right. So let's talk about your book here. You recently released a book called A Guide to Movie-Based Video Games, specifically from the years 1982 to the year 2000. What made you want to cover this topic in the first place? What drew you to covering video games based on movie licenses?
I think it's just that I had such a history with them in my life. Like there was very little, well, there was research to be done writing this book, obviously, but less research than there would be other topics, because I had actually, whether foolishly or not, bought a lot of these games in my life, you know, and played them out of this kind of morbid curiosity of how bad could it be or how good could it be. I just wanted a book that was accessible to, like, my son loves picking up a big hardback gaming book, opening it up to a random page and just having a look. So I wanted to write something like that. And I wanted it to be where even non-gamers could open it and go, oh my God, I know, you know, the movie All Dogs Go to Heaven. And just read about it. I didn't know there was a game of that, or Austin Powers, you know, Pinball or whatever. So I wanted to make it accessible. I wanted to make it funny, because some of the games, the fact that they even exist is just funny to me. Yeah, that was the kind of logic behind it. I wanted it to be colorful, bright. I wanted it to be a simple read, one that you wouldn't have to read, you know, from cover to cover. You could just open it on a page, maybe get that hit of nostalgia. That's kind of where it came from. I just wanted to write my own sort of encyclopedia style book that just covered, you know, loads of pop culture, basically.
I really enjoy that, because it's one of those things where, like, yes, a lot of this information is available online, but it's not compiled into one spot, sort of. And this, if you wanted to, for example, listeners, if you wanted to, we'll go with the James Bond panel that I've been doing. If you want to learn about all the James Bond movies, yeah, you can go to Wikipedia and look at a list. And even that list doesn't even have everything on it. But you can go to Wikipedia and look at that list. But even then, that's just a list. You don't know what the games are like. And in Chris's book here, he gives a little blurb about the games, a little, sometimes depending on how much is available, a little bit of history involved. Mm-hmm. I also like that if you want something outside of just James Bond, now you don't have to trounce around the internet. You can, like you said, you can just literally pick up, turn to a random page. And in fact, you mentioned the All Dogs Go to Heaven game, and I went to that page and I went, excuse me, there's a game based off All Dogs Go to Heaven.
That's exactly what I was hoping for. And I've seen people, you know, non-gamers in my life, let's say people I work with, who have opened it and go, oh my God, I remember Aladdin on, you know, whether it's the SNES or the Mega Drive.
Actually,
battle there over which one is better.
Yeah, this is a hot question. What's your hot take? What's better, the SNES version or the Mega Drive?
I can't say that it isn't tainted by, you know, nostalgia for me, but I'm going to say the Mega Drive. Even though Aladdin, I don't even know if he even wields a sword at any point in the movie, but he does in the Mega Drive.
Well, the Mega Drive version, I believe the what the Disney animators worked on that. Like the Super Nintendo one, they did not, but it's still a really good game.
Yeah, it's actually developed by Capcom as well, which is surprising.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Interesting one.
Yeah, so and when you were doing research for this topic, how did you, what was your approach to research? And where did you start? Like which, I guess the question I'm trying to ask is like, you have this book broken up into different categories, you know, like Bond-based movies, Disney-based movie game, or games based off Disney movies, games mm-hmm. based off Bond movies, games based off of horror movies, game based, you know, the different genres, different companies, different franchises. So where did you kind of start and what was your approach to research?
The main start for the book was trying to figure out the structure, like you said. I toyed with doing it alphabetically. I thought that would be cool. But then I wanted to make it a bit more haphazard, the way my mind works. So what I did was I started to jot down entries from the games I was really familiar with, the ones that I knew like the back of my hand, The Lion King, Aladdin, Small Soldiers on the PS1, you know, random mm-hmm. games like that. And obviously I had to go to various sites and things like that to make sure I got details like publisher, developer, release year, so many different formats for these games. You know, some games came to like 10, maybe 11 different platforms. You have all the handhelds, all the home consoles, computers, PC, Mac, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So the main thing was getting all of the release details and publishers, developers correct first. And then, now I'm sure, as much as I'm proud of the book, I probably left out someone's favorite game out of that book. But I tried to fit in as many different ones as I knew. So I went off my own, off the top of my head. I know there's a game of this. I know there's a game of that. And then I had to really go deep dive into like websites like Moby Games and stuff like that, trying to find, you know, entire histories of series and see, you know, was there one I missed? Was there a random interactive CD-ROM of some movie that I've left out? And even so, I was kind of going, do I need to put that in? Does that count as a game? Will people miss it if it's left out? It was actually a lot of work. I'd say the writing, as hard as it was not the main work. It was more trying to figure out what to include, what to leave out, and how to structure it, basically.
That makes sense. Because, yeah, they're like not like I was curious about this, and I hope this doesn't come off as like passive aggressive. I don't intend it to. But when reading the James Bond section, I did notice two very obscure titles that I found literally by happenstance in my own research, but neither, just to be clear, neither of them are based off of any games or movies. And one was, it was a 007 racing game for the Commodore 64 from like the mid 80s. And it's awful. If you can find a video of it on YouTube, and it's the worst rendition of the Bond theme you'll ever hear in your life.
I definitely did miss that one.
Well, there, and then there was one that you would have only found because it was a bundle package with the ZX Spectrum Plus 2. And it had two original games that went with a light gun, but they're just light gun games, like nothing really to write home about. You know what I mean? Like, it's fascinating though, but it like you said, like you had to curate this a little bit because there's certain things where it's like, does this count?
That's it. Exactly. I mean, it was hard to, you know, I had to put in things like the Clueless CD-ROM because I was like, look, someone's going to say you didn't put Clueless in there. So, yeah.
Alicia Silverstone is coming for you.
Yeah, she's going to get me. She's like, what? This is my shining moment and you took it away from me. You could have put it in print forever. It was tough to figure out what to leave in and what to take out. That's why I kind of, whether selfishly or not, if you notice at the start, a lot of the chapters I'll write, here are some of the best games based on this. Because I was like, if someone comes at me and goes, hey, you left out X, Y, or Z, I'll be like, well, look, I said some of.
Honestly, it's smart to do that. Like, even in my own episodes, there'll be times where it's like, oh, what is it? I did a series on the history of RTS games, mm-hmm. and I mentioned in it, like, Dune 2 is pretty much like the progenitor of all the RTS genre. Like, it's arguably the most. What I said on the episode was like, dude, now we get, you know, I talked about, I think, like three or four games on that episode in my series of RTS games. And I'm like, for the most important game on this episode, it's Dune 2 and blah, blah, blah. And I was just kind of trying to cover my ass because, you know, like, I don't know what people consider the most important game in the RTS genre. I would personally say Dune 2. And wouldn't you know it? Someone commented, it was like, it's not the most important game on this episode. It's the most important game, period. And I went, Jesus Christ, come on, man.
That kind of swung the other way, didn't it?
Yeah, I was just so mad about it. I'm like, dude, I get it. You're fine. Just calm down. So, like, to bring it back to you, I totally understand what you're saying. It's like, there's certain things where it's like you have to curate a list. Otherwise, you're like, it's not you have to curate it. Otherwise, you're just going to cover stuff that either A is – unless you're a giant history nerd, no one's going to care about.
That's it, exactly. And you have to, I think once you make something like that, or like those episodes you were talking about, you will never get upset at a top 10 list again, because you're like, okay, I understand you can't put in everything. And it is just, it's the writer's opinion. It's, you know, it's what you're going to put down. And that's just the way it is, I guess.
Now, I know you're a big horror fan based off of what I've, you know, I think I saw on your Twitter, your Twitter account. You're a big horror fan. Was it really fun for you to research all the horror movies in this book?
Absolutely. Yes. I loved that chapter probably more than anything. And some of the most fun ones for me were the Blair Witch games. There was a trilogy of kind of survival horror Blair Witch games that all came out within a year of each other. Well, all in 1 year, let's say. And they used the same engine as this other game called Nocturne that was real spooky and played with light, and it was kind of atmospheric. And I mean, I don't know if people would consider them good games. I had to try and put my nostalgia at the door, but I did praise some of the games in the book that I just like unashamedly. Evil Dead, there's only one Evil Dead game in this book. There'll be the rest of them in the second part. But I love Hail to the King on the PlayStation 1. It's such a great game, I think. It's ridiculously tough, and half of the game is battling with the controls more than the demons. Yeah, it was a great fun. I'm such, like, if I sit down at night and I'm looking through Netflix or looking through Disney or whatever, it's horror is what I go for. It's like my comfort. I don't know if that says anything about me, but
no, I know I have a lot of friends who are the same way. I'm always confused by it because I'm a scaredy boy. I don't like horror movies unless they're like older ones where I can like mentally separate myself from it, like a lot of like the Friday the 13th and the Nightmare on Elm Street and like a lot of the ones from the 80s and earlier, because it's like, well, it's, you know, that's 40 years ago. That's I don't have to worry about that anymore. Mike Myers can't get me.
Exactly. And you might see Freddy Krueger when he falls over the edge of the stairs. I think it's in the first movie, and there's a mattress left on the stairs that he lands on. And it's like perfectly in the shot. So yeah, it takes you out a bit. Not that serious.
I love flubs like that, though. It's so amusing to me.
Me too. It really makes it. And it like that, if you are, you know, prone to getting scared, that can give you like a sigh of relief. You're like, this isn't real.
What would be some, just tangentially connected to the gaming stuff, but, you know, very much a segue from what we were just talking about, what's like one of your favorite horror franchises? I'm not going to ask your favorite of all time, unless you know that off the top of your head. But
yeah.
Evil, you do? Then go
Dead.
For it.
Evil Dead would be my favorite franchise. Well, I love all five movies in that now, and the TV show Ash versus Evil Dead. I just think they're perfect. I could watch them any time of any day. Well, not when my children are around, obviously, but you know, I could watch them as many times and never get bored. I also love Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The original one is probably one of my favorites. Horror movies ever. There's also a really good movie, and I think you could watch this because it's more comedy than horror. It's on Shudder, and it's called Deadstream. It's a fantastic movie, and it's about a disgraced YouTuber who decides to win back his audience by spending a night in a supposedly haunted house, and it's just so funny. It is honestly one of the funniest movies I've ever seen.
I might have to check that out, because I do like horror comedy. Like, one of my, like, if you ask me my favorite horror movie, it's Tucker and Dale vs. Evil.
Oh, that's a great movie. I love that movie
so much. It is one of my favorite. I was so surprised by it. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I like a movie like that where you can kind of, it's got heart, you know, and you can root for someone in it, and you're really like, oh my God, they're really done wrong in that movie, those guys.
Alan Tudyk is brilliant in that movie. And I think Tyler Sabine plays the other main character.
Yeah.
I just, so many moments. It's so quotable too.
It really is. I actually need to watch that tonight again now that you've reminded me. But if you like that, yeah, that's the same vein as Deadstream. It has a bit of gross out stuff in it, but it's all in humor. You know,
I think I could get used to that. So like, it's funny. So you said your favorite is Evil Dead. I've only ever seen the first one. Mm-hmm. And I do intend to see the second, because everyone says like that's where it kind of like came into its own. Because the first one, oh my God, dude, I know it's cheesy 80s special effects, but it still makes me gag. I don't know what it is about the first Evil Dead, but the gore in that movie just really gets under my skin. It's like something fierce.
Oh, it's so visceral. And it is like that movie is a pure horror movie. There's,
yeah,
like you might laugh at one or two unintentional moments in it, but it's not meant to be funny. But Evil Dead 2 is, if someone was to ask me, you know, what is the Sam Raimi movie, I would say it's Evil Dead 2. It has everything that makes him the director that he is, and Bruce Campbell is just, oh, I don't know, he's a gift.
I also, the last thing I'll say on it before we move back towards the book, I'm also actually a fan of the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie. It's not something that, it was like one of those movies where I loved watching it. I loved seeing it for the first time. I don't know if I could watch it again because it unsettled me so much.
Yeah.
Because like I said, I'm not a horror fan, but like it was one of those ones where I watched it and I'm like, holy shit, I see why everyone, like why they consider this a good movie. Like, it,
absolutely, yeah.
Like everything about it, just like the tone and the, like it stuck with me. I would say my favorite horror movie that's like an actual horror movie is Alien. I love the first Alien movie. Oh,
that's
movie.
Fantastic. What a great movie. That's probably as perfect a movie as you can get from start to finish. The atmosphere, the music, everything. It's great.
Yeah, it works for me. But anyway, we'll get back to the book. While researching the book, I asked about like where did you start and what was your approach to it, but like was there any surprising discoveries you made, something that shocked you that you weren't expecting to learn when you were doing research for this?
That's a good question. Well, there was I think when it came to, funny enough, actually kind of segued into it there with Alien, I didn't realize just how many games there were of the Alien series.
I mean, technically you could have included Metroid in all this.
That's true, yeah, exactly. Ripley, Ridley, all that stuff, and the whole atmosphere. The first Alien game that I would have had any interaction with was Alien 3 on the Mega Drive, and mm-hmm. then Alien Trilogy and all that kind of stuff. So I had no idea that there was so many, you know, computer-based Alien games. And there was Alien 2 Aliens, or Aliens Alien 2, or whatever it's called, was Japanese only, and it had
and it had
Nobu Uematsu, you know, of Final Fantasy music fame.
He
did the soundtrack for it. Like that. I totally bizarre. And Little Nicky as well on the Game Boy Color. That was another one that I thought it was fake. You know, you see these Twitter accounts that have fake box out of the day, and I was like, Little Nicky, like Adam Sandler, Little Nicky. There's a game of that, and there is. On the Game Boy
Color. I actually did know about that game, believe it or not. I've seen it before. I've never played it, but I remember seeing it. That's really funny. The thing that blows my mind the most, though, is that Nobuo Uematsu did a Aliens soundtrack, like for a game. I'm going to have to try to look it up. What system was it for?
That's a good question. I wish I could remember off the top of my head.
You know what? I have your book downloaded right here. I can search for it on.
I'm sure it was one of the older computing kind of systems. I don't think it made it to, or could have been. Was it on the NES or the Famicom?
There is Aliens the computer game from 1987, and it was for the MSX, Commodore 16, Commodore 64. Actually, you know what? Why am I doing this? I can type in, I can just type in Uematsu and tell you exactly what it was for. Alien 2.
That's it.
Japan only, developed by Square, published by Square, released in 1987 for the MSX.
Yes, that's it. Okay. Clearly, I left all my knowledge on the page.
And listeners, just in case you want to buy this book and want to know what page this is on, page 65. So there you go.
Oh, thank you.
No problem. The PDF review copy I got is very handy for that. That would have taken me a lot longer. I love owning a physical book, but you know, I'm not going to complain about a review copy. So Yeah. Were there any games that you covered that you were initially not interested at all in, but then after doing research, you were pleasantly surprised by that the game was actually like fun or at least interesting or something like that? Was there a game, or, you know, maybe it was Little Nicky, you know, like this doesn't look good. And then you actually did research and you became intrigued by it. Was there any games like that?
There was games, you know what? Actually, this is, I'm getting confused now because I have the book has two parts. So I'm like trying to think of the overall project. You know, 007 Racing. And actually there's a guy on Twitter who reviewed my book and he did like it, but he had took umbrage with my 007 Racing entry because I was slightly positive about it. And he despises the game with a passion. But I remember renting that game for a weekend. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever played Driver on the PS1. Driver was a great game. And Stuntman on the PS2, those games. I love that kind of tactical, yeah, objective-based racing. So I had nothing but love for 007 Racing when it came out. I absolutely loved it, that you could drive, do all these cool stunts, and also shoot guns from your car, you know? That was one that I'll admit I didn't think of, because when I started writing the book, I had it in my head, I'm just going to do games that are directly based on movie. You know, all I would do for Star Wars would be episodic titles or ones that directly adapted events, you know, like Jedi power battles and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I was like, I'm doing a disservice to things like Indiana Jones or James Bond if I don't put all of the games in, you know, because technically they all come from the film franchise or the novel franchise, let's say, with James Bond. So there was things like that I was going to leave out completely. And I was like, I can't do this. There's too many good Star Wars games. Like, that would mean leaving out Jedi Knight, you know, and Dark Forces, mm-hmm, and things like that. And I just couldn't.
Dark Forces.
That's right. I just couldn't do it. So
a great Doom clone.
Yeah, it was. Doom's the master. Yeah. So things like that. I was going to actually, like, the book could have been much shorter, but I was like, no, I need to get these things on the page just in case, you know, if one person sees a game and goes, oh, I want to play that, then that's my job done.
I mean, there's a couple in here, like All Dogs Go to Heaven, like I mentioned already. I'm still, and now this Alien 2, Japanese only release, like that. I'm sorry, that just blows my mind. I need to see this game in like now. After we're done recording, I want to go check it out. Yeah. Are there any books or are there any movies that like, they're games that you were expecting to be? So the first one I asked was, there just kind of something surprising, but I guess like in general, was there any like franchises, like whether it's like Disney or Pixar, where like you were expecting a game to be one thing and it turned out to be something totally different?
Off the top of my head, that's a tough one. I'm sure there were mini game collections that I hoped would have been fully fledged games. Nothing's leading to my, you know what, actually Mulan on the Game Boy, I have a bit of an affinity for because I have it and I bought it when I was a kid, but that game is just so inaccessible in every single way. And coming off the heels of things like Aladdin and The Lion King, which is only when you look back on it now, really, really tough, you know, that's notoriously one of the hardest games ever, but I didn't think that at the time because I was just a kid playing, having fun. But like Mulan, I think it only came to the Game Boy, and it's just the most inaccessible, rigid, strangely developed game. One of the strangest ones in the book, I think. It's so, if you played it now and you had never had previous experience of it, you would probably put, you know, throw your device through the window within 5 minutes easily. So yeah, that could have been way better. I was disappointed.
If you don't mind, I'm going to shout out a game that I had as a kid, but I think it's one that people often overlooked. N64, Toy Story 2, Buzz Lightyear to the Rescue.
That is one of the greatest platformers of all time, I would argue.
That's a higher price than I was expecting, but for the N64, yeah, like it's no Mario 64 or Banjo-Kazooie or like even Donkey Kong 64, though I do think, let me put it this way, I think Donkey Kong 64 has better platforming challenges, but all the collectathon stuff can be over tedious at times unless you like collectathons. Toy Story 2 is a much more concise version of that with some frame rate issues. I adore Toy Story 2.
I really do too. I think the whole Toy Story series has been treated really well when it comes to games. Like, it, like, you know, I'm saying this in my own opinion, but even, you know, the side-scrolling versions for the Mega Drive and SNES and stuff like that of the original movie were good. But mm-hmm. Toy Story 2, yeah, it really made, like, it's like a really neat contained version, like you said, of something like Mario 64 or Banjo-Kazooie. You know, it's always clear what your objective is. There's loads of atmosphere in it, I find, for a movie-based game. It's like they took the basic premise of the movie, but they went crazy with it and just made their own thing. And I think it's a great introduction, especially for younger kids, if they wanted to get used to that type of game. You know, that there was loads of them on the N64. Donkey Kong, Banjo-Kazooie, Banjo-Tooie, Conker's Bad Fur Day to a lesser extent. Yeah, I think it's a great game. That's a great choice.
That one, dude, I actually did, I don't know if it's going to be out by the time this episode drops, but I did a guest spot on another podcast called Remember 64. And I asked specifically, like, I asked the host, was like, hey, what are some of your favorite N64 games? And I'm like, well, I could go with some of the obvious ones, but let me go with one that I don't think anyone's going to want to pick. And so I went with Toy Story 2. I'm like, this game is a really good game that nobody talks about. I wouldn't quite put, like I said, wouldn't quite put it at like your Mario 64s, your Banjo-Kazooies.
Yeah.
But it's fantastic. Sorry, were you going to say something?
No, I was just, I did probably go over the top saying that it was one of the best platformers of all time, but that was for someone who was so into Toy Story at the time when it came out. I was like, this is like, this is as good as having, you know, another movie, like two movies at once.
I can honestly, you're not entirely off with that, because I think the thing that blows me away about that game is that every level feels real in a weird sense. Like, specifically the first level. The first level in that game is you play as Buzz Lightyear in Andy's house, and you have to escape to rescue Woody. You have to escape the house to rescue Woody, because he was captured by Al and taken to Al's toy barn and all that other stuff. And Buzz has to go rescue him. But the house is fully realized. Like, there's a whole section in Andy's room where there's like, each room has a different puzzle. Then you go out to the hallway. You can either go downstairs, which has a garage, a living room, a kitchen, or you can go upstairs into the attic, which is a really fun way to platform to get up to. You have to like climb up a plant to run across like a side table, like a table in the hallway, and then you jump from the table in the hallway to the drawstring that like is directly above the attic, which for some reason is wide open, but you know, video game logic, you don't think too hard on it.
That's true.
And then you climb up, and then there's a boss up there, and you can explore the rafters of the attic and stuff like that. And you go downstairs, and in the garage, you race RC car. Well, also, there's all the workbenches there that you have to dodge, like drills and enemies and all this other stuff, and platform your way across it. And then you can even go down into the basement, which has a whole nother, like, the house feels like a real house, which is incredibly impressive, in my opinion, for something back then, like, especially from a licensed game, which normally licensed games, as you know, aren't always great. And it's funny because, like, Toy Story for the Mega Drive and whatnot, I actually can't stand. Like, it looks really nice.
Yeah.
The Mega Drive and Super Nintendo, it looks really nice. But specifically the platforming in that game, Woody takes like the string out of his back and he has to loop it on things to swing across.
That's right.
It's fucking impossible, dude.
It is. And it's very, that game is like, Toy Story 2 is chaotic in a way that works. The original Toy Story game is just chaotic in that things are just hurting you left, right, and center. And you're like, where is that even coming from?
Things that shouldn't hurt you at all. Like, you'll run into a block that's stationary and Woody goes like, bleh.
Yeah, that's so true. And I'm all for trial and error, you know, when it comes to gaming, but that game has a lot of it where, like, there is no possible way, if you were playing it for the first time, that you could know that train was going to hurt you or this was going to hurt you. Yeah, it's a bit. But yeah, when you talk about Toy Story 2, it really makes me want to, it takes me back to, like, you know, those jumps you have to do where you're like holding your breath when you make that jump, and then his little wingspan, the double jump thing, helps you get that bit further. It's a really fun game.
There's a lot of verticality to it. Like, there's so many, besides just Andy's house, like the very next level, you're in like Andy's neighborhood and there's a giant tree you can climb up.
Yeah.
It's really fun. And the level at, then there's a boss level. Then the fourth level is a construction yard where you climb up the rafters, like the construction beams.
It's really well, well, I wasn't say well constructed game, but like, that semi open world thing that it has is really impressive. And I think the fact that it, you know, I know Woody being kidnapped is kind of the focus of the movie as well, but it was a kind of a ballsy move of the developers to focus so much on Buzz and not have Woody. You know, he's barely in the game at all.
Yeah.
So they really took a lot of risks. They really made their own thing. I'd love to know when they started, you know, full development of that game and how many, you know, of the movie's assets they had, or, you know, it really seems like it could have been its own thing. You could have slapped a different character model on everything in that game and made it its own platform. Yeah. It still would have been good.
I've said a bunch of times, it's just underrated, man. It's, no one talks about it, and I feel like people should. It's a really solid 3D platformer. And what was I gonna say? I wonder, so my buddy Pat Hickey Jr., he's an author as well. He writes a book series called The Minds Behind the Games, which I don't know, maybe I shouldn't be shouting on another author's book.
That's okay. Definitely.
We'll get back to I'll say it again. A Guide to Movie-Based Video Games, 1982 to 2000. So there we go. I just evened it out there. But he interviews a lot of game devs and stuff, and so he might have something on this. I'd be very curious. I might actually reach out to him after we're done recording.
That'd be very cool. I'd love to know more about that, you know, just the thinking behind it.
So the people who made Toy Story 2 was Traveler's Tales, and they actually, I believe, did the first Toy Story game as well.
They did Bug's Life,
and they did the original one. Yeah. And they actually did Buzz Lightyear of Star Command, which I have not played that one, but they did all those. They now do all the Lego games.
Yeah, that's right. They've been pretty much the sole developer of those for how long now? Nearly 20 years when you think about it.
Oh my God, you're right. That can't be real. There can't be 20 years of Lego games already.
When you think about, like, there's more than that really, but like, if you're talking about the start of the movie licensed ones, let's say, like Lego Star Wars, that must have been, what, 2004, 2005, nearly 20 years. Maybe I'm being generous.
That's so wild to think about.
It's crazy, isn't it? And they haven't really changed all that much.
2005, like, it's disturbing to me that 2003 is 20 years ago now.
Yeah, I know. That makes no sense to me either. I don't think it ever will.
It was only 10 years ago.
20 years ago to me is the 80s.
Yeah. Same. For me, 10 years ago was the 90s, 20 years ago was the 80s, and like 30 was the 70s. Because, you know, I high school and whatnot, I grew up in the 2000s as my, like, it's like preteen and teenage years. So that's always my frame of reference. And now I'm almost 20 years out of high school now, which is just, that can't be true. I've said this on other shows. I have a theory that games age you, not like actually age you, but like in terms of, by comparison, games age you quicker than almost any other medium because they evolved so quickly. Yeah. So like games for us growing up, like you said, you grew up with the microcomputers, you know, the Commodore 64 and the Amigas. And I'm old enough that I was born in 89, so I should have grown up with like the Super Nintendo, but I didn't get a system until I was 10, so I didn't get one till I got an N64 as my first console. But even so, with the N64, like, you look at N64 and you look at graphics now, it's only 30 years apart, practically 30 years apart, but there's a huge difference.
Yeah, there is a massive difference. It's kind of scary. And I totally agree with you that it ages you, because when you look how far it's come in such a short time, more than any other medium, probably. It definitely makes you feel like, ooh, this is going too fast.
I also wonder if, because like 2D games are kind of having a second renaissance now, they have been for the last like 5 or 6 years, where like, maybe even the last decade or so, since like, you know, what, Shovel Knight came out like 2013 or 14 or whatever.
Yeah, it was kind of around the kind of Xbox Live arcade boom you know, things started going, not backwards, but people started looking back at that kind of that style.
And finding new ways to make them, to modernize them. Yeah. And I wonder when you, because you look at like Super Mario World, right? That game, and even like the original Sonic, those games still look really good. Yeah. The art direction is borderline flawless. And so when you look at that and you're like, wow, that, you know, and then you look at something like Shovel Knight or Hollow Knight or, and Ori does has it more. I was going to say Ori in the Blind Forest, but that's more of a modern, that's more of like a watercolor art style sort of.
Celeste,
or
Celeste is a pretty good one. I really
Thank you. And you look at Celeste and you're like, wow, these all look kind of similar because they all use pixel graphics. Mm-hmm. But then you say Super Mario World is 30 years old and Celeste is only like four. You're like, what?
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? Like, and those are just, it's those big chunky sprites, you know, on the screen. They really knew how to make it timeless, like especially developers like Sega and Nintendo. They really just knew. I don't know how they knew. They must have had some kind of crazy clairvoyance, but like they really do stand the test of time. And that's why they're on so many services now, like the Switch Online and stuff like that. Because you can play them and you're not like, oh, this is old. I don't want to play this. I remember this being better. But no, you play it and you're like, this is still really good.
Yeah, exactly. I think specifically in art direction, a lot of those still hold up. Sometimes in game design, you can see some of the their age, but even so, it's not that bad. What was I going to say? Moving on, though, I wanted, in speaking, we were talking about a bunch of games here. How, for this book, how did you balance playing the games versus like just doing research? Because like I can't imagine like having to, like, were you able to find time to play all these games, or did you use kind of a combination of like, you know, obviously you have the gaming from memory, but then you also have trying out new games. Did you have to play every single one, or were you able to get a good vibe about them just from like, you know, on like doing research online? And by the way, listeners, there's no shade in not playing a game when you're doing research on it, because sometimes these games are inaccessible. Like there's like some games you just cannot play any other way except for finding someone who was kind enough to upload a video of their real hardware onto YouTube or something like that. So just heading any criticism of that shit off of the past, just in case. So, but yeah, Chris, how many of these were you actually able to play? Was it a lot of them, or was it kind of a more of a mix?
I'm really happy that you prefaced that entire section with that observation, because it is true. It was a mix. I would say if I was to be brutally honest, I probably played, I'm going to say 70%, 75%.
Of That's the really book, fucking good.
Which is, and it was hard. You know, obviously, I'm not going to lie, there was a lot of emulation involved. There was a lot of, for the things that I didn't get around to, whether it was time-wise or accessibility-wise, there's so many playthroughs on YouTube and stuff like that. And a lot of really good analysis by people and, you know, just tidbits from the net and stuff that you find. Luckily, like a lot of the games, especially Mega Drive and PlayStation 1 and N64, that era, I would have just played, you know, from renting from my local store or buying, whether foolishly or not. So there was a lot of watching, there was a lot of playing, and there was a lot of writing, but no, I would say 70% maybe.
70%. That's really, I mean, you cover, I think, what is it, like over 200 or 300 games? So
there's only 300 in there. I actually can't remember the exact amount. I'm sure I had it written down somewhere, but no, it's gone now.
Yeah, so even covering 70% of that at the very least is like, you know, that's, you're looking at over 200 games out of the 300. It's like 220 some odd that like, and like I said, and that's why I wanted to preface it, because some people get really bent out of shape over like, why are you reviewing a game that you haven't played? I'm like, do you want to find an Amiga and find a way to get it to work again? Yeah. And also on top of that, what if you're a lot of these things we're on time crunches. I don't have time to spend 40 hours just trying to figure out the text parser of a text game, of a text adventure. You know, that's what it, I mean?
Exactly. Like, yeah. And some, like, you know, I won't talk too much about the second part of this book because we're focusing on the first part, but because I went so retro in this book with the, you know, Commodore 64 and stuff like that, I wanted to show the other side in the next book. So I obviously did a lot of apps, you know, of things that were, you know, random things like Frozen that got, you know, match three tile kind of stuff. And some of those games are just not available anymore. Like they're not on an app store anymore, so you can't play them. So you have to look up, YouTube videos, you have to look up patch notes and updates and kind of get a feel for what these games are about. And it's like that with older games too, which is why I'm definitely very much in favor of game preservation if people can do it in a way that's, I don't know, ethical, if that makes sense.
No, it does. Side note, just to cover your bases as well. By the way, anyone listening to this, he was a good boy. He deleted his ROMs after 24 hours. Yes. Nothing illicit was going on.
Absolutely. Yep.
Everything's over the table.
I don't know.
I was going to say over the table. That's not an expression.
Above board. That's it.
There we go. Thank you.
No, but
I'm with you on the game preservation thing. There is a weird thing that came out recently, you know, like the Video Game History Foundation out there doing the Lord's work.
Yeah.
Released a study that like over 80% of games released before 2010 are just completely inaccessible now. And of course, a vast majority of people are like, well, you can just download emulators and ROMs and blah, blah, blah. And they're missing the point. Yeah. Like, even if you don't have an ethical or moral dilemma with ROMs and emulation, piracy should not be the end all be all to game preservation. It's done more for preservation than the people who own the copyrights. I'm not trying to like villainize, ROMs and emulation and that kind of stuff. Not in the slightest, because I've used them before and once again deleted them after 24 hours. But I've used them before, and there's nothing wrong with it. But to act as like this is the best way to preserve video games off the whims of a market, off the whims of enthusiasts, because there are games and systems out there that aren't preserved at all because no one grew up with them. So why would they spend a whole lot of time trying to care about something that they don't care about? Like, that's a lot of time and effort to emulate like a system that like the Fairchild Channel F, for example. There's probably an emulator out for it now because people are crazy, but you know, that's something that like, it's, if there's problems with the emulator and it doesn't work with all the games or anything like that, who's going to do it? Like, the person who made it, like it was a labor of love. Are they really going to dedicate more time to something that not a lot of people are even going to touch, versus if you have something, if you can have libraries help work on preserving it, like, it's a step in the right direction. Yeah. Once again, not the end all be all, but it's a step in the direction.
It's something, even if it's temporary, it's something that can preserve them that little bit longer, you know. And we don't like the film industry doesn't have to worry about that because everything gets 4K steelbook or gets a Blu-ray release, or even the most obscure thing can either be found fully on YouTube or can be found, you know, in a physical copy. And we don't have that luxury, which is sad because what we talked about at the start, everyone's had a different start to their gaming life and every console and system means something different to different people. So that's why, you know, I understand when people love their digital games. I do think it's handy. It's convenient. You know, you can preload, you can play something at midnight and all that, but I still am physical collector. I don't know, it's just something I enjoy. I feel like I don't have the game unless I have it, and I do have plenty of digital games. I download loads of games, I do, but yeah, there's something about it, like, we shouldn't have to go searching so hard for these games, especially when they only came out in the last, what's, let's say 50 years, let's give it that time frame. You shouldn't have to, you know, dig too deep to find things like that. It's disappointing.
I mean, the movie industry had their own growing pains with this, but like the first, like, what, 40 years of cinema history are just lost forever.
That's true, actually. Yeah,
like, it's like 90% of it is just gone. Like, when the Video Game History Foundation released the report, it's not that you can't get 80, like, there's plenty of those games that they listed that are, you can get on ROMs easily, like relatively easily. But once again, that's not really the point. Like, if you should not have to break the law in order to preserve games.
Yeah.
That's really the long and the short of it is what it comes down to. So anyway, I could talk about game history forever, dude. It's something I'm super passionate about as well. So I totally understand where you're coming from. And I know we're not talking about, I'm assuming then your next book, the second part to this, is 2000 to current or present.
It's called 2001 onwards, because there's some things that had funny release dates. I wanted to get it as up to date as I could, but obviously there's kind of 4 months, 5 months-ish between when you send off your final proof, let's say, of the PDF, and then the book actually comes out. So you have to make a cutoff point. But it was actually the publisher suggesting to just call it 2001 onwards, because it just covers, you know, it doesn't give me a direct end date. So it kind of goes up to, you know, 2022-ish. There might be a mention of a 2023 game in there, but yeah, so it's 2001 onwards.
I getcha. Like the reason I brought it up is because when we're talking about preservation, you mentioned the phone apps. Like, yes, I don't give two shit. On a personal level, I don't give two shits about phone, like, yeah, app gaming, but they are still video games, and it's not for me to say what's important or not, what's to preserve. Like, I can't stand Farmville, but how the hell do you preserve Farmville when it's That's a it. Face? You know?
Exactly. Yeah, and you just go into your app store and it's just either not there anymore, or it's you know, you can't click download. It's a funny one. Where do they go? Just into the ether.
They just disappear. Or like, yeah. There's actually, I've had on on my show, I had on two guys, Rockman Cosmo and Naoya Shinoda, and they are working on preserving Japanese feature phone games.
All right, very good.
Yeah, so they talk about the difficulties with that, because a lot of them are locked to different phones, and like, you have to be connected to their self service, which a lot of them are now no longer available. So it's like they have to find phones with games installed on them already. Wow. And then find someone who knows how to finagle the code to jailbreak the game, essentially, so it doesn't require the internet connection.
That is next level, isn't it? I mean,
it's really wild, man.
I have a Nokia Engage here that I need to keep going so I can play all my old games. And Engage, exactly. QD, not the one that you had to hold sideways, the one that you could hold like a proper phone. Things like
that's
that.
That's awesome. Yeah. You have an Engage, though.
I do, and it does still work, to the best of my knowledge. It's somewhere here in this house. I have Call of Duty. I have that Elder Scrolls Travels Shadow Key game, which is apparently goes for a lot online that I didn't know. I saw one for 500 on eBay. obviously people are looking for this random terrible Elder Scrolls game from the N-Gage. I don't know why, but yeah, I'm going to try and keep that for as long as I can.
That is just wild. Moving into kind of like the last question I have based around your book, and then we'll kind of go into our wrap-ups. What's a movie that you wish had a video game adaptation but does not?
Oh, that's such a great question. For me, it would probably come more from the recent side of things. I think that every Disney and Pixar movie that comes out basically makes me think of Toy Story 2, like you said. You know, I love Moana. I love that movie. I think it's great. Wouldn't it be so cool if there was a 3D platform game of that, you know, for modern consoles? I think the fact that we're deprived of that nowadays is one of the saddest things for me. I'd love that for my kids and for me, because I play it too, let's be honest. Those are the ones that hit me hardest, that we don't get, you know, because for as many terrible animated movie video games as there are, there were some really good ones, you know, that were genuinely fun and inventive, and I had a lot of good times playing. So I wish the Disney, Pixar, even, you know, Illumination, we didn't get like a Despicable Me platformer, you know, that kind of stuff would have been amazing, I think.
I'm with you on that. In general, I kind of want to see a return of 3D platformers. I feel like we've kind of gotten away from them, sort of.
Yeah.
You know, you still have your Mario Odyssey and whatnot, but like, and obviously some of there's some newer ones. Had in Time, I have not played, but I've heard it's very good. The Yooka-Laylee games. Yeah. You know, from former Rare employees. So that's
Balan Wonderworld tried anyway.
Oh, Yuji Naka. that game, I did not try that game. I love that it took a swing. I'm kind of bummed that it ended up not being the most popular game.
I actually haven't played it either, but the last time I saw it, like all of the GameStops in Ireland have closed for some reason in the last month. They're all shut down and the website is gone. But the last time I was in there, I saw Balan Wonderworld. I think it was on PS5 and it was $4.99. So, you know.
Yuji Naka needs that money for his trials.
Exactly.
Poor Yuji Naka. Yeah, I know, I'm with you on that. I just in general, man, I want to see more 3D platformers. I think that's my favorite, next to 2D, that's my favorite genre, and we haven't really seen them since like the PS2 era, like really. There's been a couple, you know, Ratchet and Clank still has those elements and whatnot, but I kind of miss like seeing a bunch of 3D platformers. I would really love to see that make a return.
Totally agree. And something else, not to side note too much, but I'd love to see, I don't know if it would happen, but we've seen, you know, like you said, a return to kind of pixel art and 2D games. I would love if they could go back and visit older movies and give them that treatment. So let's say like Jurassic World, the trilogy that came out with Chris Pratt, like make a side-scrolling game similar to the Mega Drive SNES or the top-down one from the SNES. Make those kind of things of new movies, like Way Forward did with the Mummy, the Tom Cruise Mummy, demastered that game. That like that's cool. I'd love to see that happen more, or go back and do the newest Star Wars trilogy, but make, you know, the super games that came out to SNES, like Super Return of the Jedi, but do like Super The Force Awakens, Super The Last Jedi. You know, make them side-scrolling, you know, 16-bit games. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see that happen. It won't happen, but that's a little pipe dream I kind of hold on to.
That would still be cool. I'm with you on that. Or like go back to even further and do like movies from like the 2000s that you didn't really like. Underworld. Let's see an Underworld third person shooter.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
Right?
Yeah.
Before we go into the plugs, I want to ask real quick. I want to ask you to talk about some of your other books based off of it doesn't have to be just gaming. You have a book on movie monsters, I see. The three other books you have here is a guide to video game movies. So kind of conversely, you know, this book that we've been talking about is games based off of movies, and you have a book of movies based off of games.
That's right. Yeah, that was the first one that I pitched to the publisher, and when I was typing it, I was thinking to myself, no one is going to want to read this. I'm literally the only person who cares about this. But it went down really well. I threw the book together. I love terrible movies as well. I don't know. Do I just have bad taste? Maybe I do.
But, no, you know, you're smart enough to know when it's so good, it's so bad, it's good.
That's it. Exactly. So I decided to kind of tackle, you know, the biggest, let's say, major releases from 1993 onwards. And there was animated stuff. There was animated Mario movies and stuff in the 80s. But I wanted to go from the Bob Hoskins, John Leguizamo masterpiece as far as I could. And by the time I handed the book in, I got up to Werewolves Within. I don't know if you've seen that movie.
No.
It's very good. It's actually on Netflix. It's really, really good. The game is actually a virtual reality first person kind of... It's like a murder mystery type game where you're all sitting around a campfire in a fantasy village. One of you is the werewolf, but you don't know who. And you have to kind of hand this sheet around and learn about the other people and try and guess who it is before they eat you. But the movie takes a modern approach to it. I don't know how they managed to get it off the ground, because it's not something that anyone really knows about. But I would say,
seriously, I've never even heard of this. I never even heard of the game.
Yeah, Werewolves Within. I think it was only on, you know, it was, I don't know, was it just on PlayStation VR? I mean, Oculus as well, but I'm not sure. But the movie is on Netflix. I'm sure it's on Netflix in the US. It is here anyway, but like I would highly recommend that movie because it is so funny and so well made. So yeah, that was my first book, and I got everything in there that I could. Unfortunately, it came out right before like Mario and Uncharted and all these other big movies, so I didn't get to put them in. But maybe I'll go back and amend it or make a second part. So guide to video game movies. And one other side note, I put up a few screenshots of like Uwe Boll movies, like Postal and Alone in the Dark, and his wife, assuming it actually is her, on Twitter liked the tweet. So I was like, that's cool. Someone's talking about you, Uwe. So my second book was The Ultimate Book of Movie Monsters. I really just wanted to write a book about, you know, every type of monster, whether it's zombies, kaiju, all that kind of stuff. So I went from black and white early stuff like Nosferatu all the way up to the most recent stuff I could think of. So it has stuff like The Descent in there, which I think is a great horror movie. It has a whole chapter on B movies, so we have crazy stuff like Evil Bong and various other movies like that. So that's just for
Toxic Avenger.
The Toxic Avenger, he's in there. Yeah, he's in there. That's right. And I can't wait to see the new movie of that, actually. And the third book is this, and what's coming out not long after this. It could be September, could be October. I'm not sure yet, depending on shipping and stuff. Is The History of the Adventure Video Game. And
you can pre-order that actually at Pen and Sword's website.
That's right. Yeah. And I took on that because The Secret of Monkey Island was kind of the thing, you know, my earliest memory. And I wasn't going to write a book on CJ's elephant antics. So I decided...
What are you talking about?
Everyone would buy that.
Who wouldn't buy a game on CJ's elephant antics?
And luckily, the guy from the publisher that I'm kind of in contact with most, he loves Broken Sword. So as soon as I pitched an adventure, point-and-click graphic adventure game book, he was like, yes, let's do it. So I did that. And then next year, you've got the second part of this book coming out, and I have two more in the works that I won't say anything about yet.
Fun fact, just thinking of adventure games, with Maniac Mansion.
Yes.
I don't know if this you already knew this, so I apologize if you did, but I always like to shout this out because this was something that blew my mind when I learned about it. So I had on my podcast a dude named Howie Rubin last year, I want to say. Howie was the president of Jolico USA.
Oh, right. Okay.
Back in the 80s. And so they're the ones that published Maniac Mansion.
Yeah.
And so, you know how in Maniac Mansion, the hamster explodes in the microwave?
Yes.
Well, they knew Nintendo wasn't going to like that, but they wanted to see, could they push it through without Nintendo noticing?
Yeah.
They did. And Nintendo did not notice.
Oh, wow.
Until the books were already, or sorry, the games were already made, manufactured, and shipping over to them so they could distribute it out to, you know, wherever else they wanted to sell it. Nintendo calls Howie, I think he was in Chicago at the time, and he goes, they're like, we found the hamster. And he goes, you can't sell this game. So at this point, you know, Nintendo's practices back then were pretty shitty. So that was... Nintendo didn't lose any money on that. They made all the money because, you know, Jolico paid for all those cartridges already.
Yeah.
So Howie looked at his contract with Nintendo and realized, and he double checked it with his lawyer, and his understanding was correct, that as long as he didn't sign for it, as long as they were not on his desk and he didn't sign for it, they were not theirs. It was still property of Nintendo's. Oh. So he called the dude back at Nintendo, goes, all right, that's fine. I can't sell. I'm not going to sign for it then. Where do you want these games to go? Because I'm not going to sign for something I can't sell.
Yeah.
He played hardball with Nintendo and ended up going to up to Minoru Arakawa, who was the head of Nintendo of America at the time. And Howie stonewalled, played a game of chicken, I guess, with Nintendo and won. And they said, yeah, you can sell these, but if you do another printing of it, you have to remove the hamster for that printing. And they did. They removed the hamster for a second printing. So there is apparently two versions of Maniac Mansion out there for the NES, one with the hamster that explodes and one where it does not.
Well, I did not know that.
I don't know if it's really like well broadcast on the internet at all. I saw it a couple other places after I did the interview with him, but it's like one of those ones, unless you're specifically looking for it, it's going to be hard to find in passing. Man,
going toe to toe with Nintendo is a brave move, and it paid off. Yeah. Obviously. That's amazing. I'm so impressed by that.
Howie, he was a very sweet man. He also worked at Atari Coin-Op back in the 70s.
Wow. Like, he's a storied history. So. That's amazing. Yeah,
he was an awesome dude. Anyway, I'm sorry, that was a digression. But I wanted you to talk about your other books that you're writing, that you have written, are writing, and you know, one's coming out. Just because there's more interesting topics. I'm a fan of movie monsters, even though I've said before I'm a scaredy boy. I'm fascinated by horror, even though I hate being scared. It's so weird. Yeah.
I get you. I totally understand that. And it's like, you know, even though it feels like a safe thrill, like a roller coaster, there's still that moment. You know, some people like being jump scared, but do you really? I mean, it gives you that split second of like, I'm going to die.
I can't stand jump scares.
Yeah, I'm still, you know what? As big a horror fan as I am, I wouldn't say that I actually like them either.
don't enjoy it.
Panic. Yeah, it's not something that, you know, shouldn't be an enjoyable feeling, I guess. But yeah, I understand that.
Well, it's funny. Like, I didn't to me, horror movies were all jump scares until I saw the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and it like really messed me up. Yeah. Like, in my head, I'm like, oh, that's what a horror movie's supposed to be.
Absolutely. And it's so cerebral. And actually, if you did watch it again, if you ever venture forth, or even just, I can tell you now anyway, it's actually like the on-screen violence is so minimal in that movie for a movie that's called Massacre.
Yeah,
it's actually really reined in. It's all about that dread that just gets under your skin, like you were saying. That's what the movie's about.
It's expertly crafted, man. One of the best movies I've seen, and it's one that I never want to see again. Yep. Because it did its job so effectively. And that's
perfectly fine. We all have a movie like that where you're like, I'm glad I watched it, but I don't want to see it again ever.
But all right, let's begin to wrap up this episode. Chris, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for joining me for this. This was a lot of fun. Before I let you go, I have two final questions for you. One, I told you a little bit about these off mic. One, of course, I ask all my guests a question from Alan Alda's podcast, Clear and Vivid, which is all about communication. He always ends his episodes with seven quick questions with seven quick answers. Okay. And usually all the questions invite more, like the answers could be elaborated on, but he just kind of wants quick hits. Okay. I'm not going to ask you all seven. I'm only asking you one. And, I guess I asked my previous interview this one, so I'm going to ask you a different one. What book changed your life?
The Hobbit.
The Hobbit. Okay. What about The Hobbit? J.R.R. Tolkien. What about it changed your life?
It was just my first proper foray into kind of high fantasy or any constructed world like that. And between my dad reading it to us, me getting to read it again when I was old enough to read it, and then this BBC audio drama of it that was really well produced, I just got so enveloped in it. So, you know, when Peter Jackson's movies came out of Lord of the Rings, everything was just Middle Earth for me. So that's why it really just gave me it was the perfect, you know, fantasy escape.
I can understand that. I actually kind of have a similar, I don't know what book for me would have changed my life exactly. I don't even know if I have it, but for me, to go with his Christian brother, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah. C.S. Lewis.
I don't really go crazy about it on the show or anything, but I am still somewhat Christian, and I just don't, you know, I don't shove it down people's throats.
Yeah.
But my parents were super, super religious and still are super, super religious. And so they would always have you don't want to read comic books and superheroes. Here, watch Bible Man. And that's a real thing. I'm not even Bible bullshitting. Man. That's a real thing, and it's awful.
Is he joining the MCU at any stage? That would be cool.
You don't want him to join the MCU.
Bible Man just comes out of a vortex.
Actually, he might be the most powerful. He can just unleash like fire and brimstone down on people.
Sounds amazing. I'd love that.
So of course that she read us like the Chronicles of Narnia and a lot of those, and it's the same thing. It like captured my first experience in like this fantasy world and really captured my imagination. I did not see a BBC or hear a BBC audio play. I did see there was a BBC live action movie in the 80s.
Yeah, I remember it.
I unironically love those but they're pure nostalgia. Like if you watch them now, like there's just humans in beaver suits.
It's like Wizard of Oz-esque level of costumes. Yeah, definitely.
It's so silly but wonderful. Anyway, so all right, so The Hobbit, that I like that. I haven't actually gotten that one yet, so my last question for you is questions from Courtney da 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 da. That normally I go with like some type of fast food jingle that was just made off of the top of my head.
You could have fooled me.
Yeah, I know, right? I should McDonald's hire me. So she always sends me a bunch so that way I can pick and choose. Mm-hmm. Here's one though. If you could choose one animal to speak the human language, I guess English in this instance, since we both speak English, if you could choose one animal to speak your language, which animal would you choose and why?
It would have to be a cat. Yeah, because I had a pet cat until I was probably age 19. Got him when I was 5. He passed away when I was 19. Long, happy life. And I have two cats now that my daughter is just obsessed with. But I would just love to know what they're thinking. Are they looking down on us? Are they happy? do they think of us as slaves? You know, when I don't want to feed them because I just fed them 5 minutes ago, are they cursing me under their cat breath? You know, I don't know. I just would love to know, because you know they have that look in their eyes where they're just like squinting and kind of looking at you. I'm like, what are you thinking? What's going on in that noggin? So yeah, definitely a cat.
Is there hatred behind those eyes, or is there just cautious love?
If they could get on the cat phone to their cat friends, they'd be like, yeah, I just have to deal with this guy for another, like, I don't know how long he's going to keep me here, but he has food, so it's all good.
It's a living, yeah. like something out of the Flintstones. But all right, that'll do it for this episode of Still Loading. Once again, Chris, thank you again for joining me, man. This was a really fun conversation, and I hope, listeners, you go check out his book. I will include a link to his book in the show notes, A Guide to Movie-Based Video Games, and of course all of his others, A Guide to Video Game Movies, Movie Monster, The Ultimate Book of Movie Monsters, and the upcoming History of the Adventure Game. So Chris, where can the good people find you, and is there anything you would like to add in terms of, you know, just your book, like a final pitch to my audience for your book?
Final pitch. I just want to say thanks to you anyway for having me on, because it has been so much fun, and this is not what I'm used to, but I love doing it. It's amazing. So thank you. Pitches for my book, just for people who like a quick, easy read that you don't have to read from cover to cover. Open it up, you recognize something, you can get a bit of trivia, you might get a bit of a recommendation, a bit of history, some nice screenshots, and hopefully it will satisfy all your pop culture needs. If you want to follow me on Twitter, which is what I call it, I'm at Chris Carton 89, C-A-R-T-O-N, like a carton of milk is the easiest way to describe it. I'm also on Instagram at Christopher Carton _ author. And I think I'm on Facebook as well, but I don't really use it. Christopher Carton -author. If you just search my name, you can find it.
You're not missing much anyway.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm not. that's all I got, really.
All right. So as per usual for myself, listeners, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Still Loading Pod on all of them. Also Hive at Still Loading Pod, Blue Sky at Still Loading Pod, and all that good stuff. You can find me on YouTube at Still Loading Podcast, Twitch at I keep doing it. There's too many places. At Still Loading Pod on places on the internet, except for YouTube, which is at Still Loading Podcast, because I have too many people trying to steal my podcast title. So we're not dealing with that crap. You can, if you want to support the show, you can do so in a number of ways. You can give it a 5-star rating or review on Apple Podcasts, because it makes me feel warm and fuzzy, and please make me feel warm and fuzzy. I would enjoy that. That sounds weird, but on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you want to make me feel weird, I guess. if you want to support the show monetarily, you can go to patreon.com/stillloadingpod for $1 a month. You'll get all the episodes a few days early, but with better audio quality and access to patron voting rights. There's quarterly polls, and the last one that won was Epic Mickey for the Wii, and I will be covering that on a future episode due out in October. So it should actually be out in a couple of weeks by the time you're hearing this. But yeah, I still have to beat the game at the time of recording. I'm about halfway through, though, so we're getting close to the end. Anyway, but yeah, so if you want to help me guide, if you want to help guide the direction of the show, you can do that at the $1 level. At the $4 level, you'll get everything I mentioned before, plus 2 bonus episodes every month. And then that covers a variety of topics of like retro magazine reviews and covering my 220-in-1 My Arcade Gamer 5 portable system, which of course, nothing but quality when you have 220 games in one system. So there's that. And then for the $5 level, you'll get everything I mentioned prior, plus access to Still Bonding, which is my monthly James Bond podcast where me and a bunch of friends bond over 007. The time this episode is dropping, we're either A View to a Kill will be just coming out or will have just come out. I'm thinking it's actually leaning towards will have just come out, but we'll see. So and the final shout out is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of kids receiving inpatient care at hospitals. So if you want to support them, please consider donating. Go to bitbybitfoundation.org. That is all the time I have for you today. Chris, once again, man, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
And I will see you all next time. Thank you.